You're listening to the Meet the Farmers podcast with me, Ben Eagle. To listen to previous episodes, visit thinkingcountry.com or find the podcast on iTunes by searching for Meet the Farmers. Hello and welcome to episode 30 of Meet the Farmers. Today I'm in the Waveney Valley of Suffolk at Fen Farm Dairy near Bungay, and I'm meeting Johnny Crickmore, who I first came across at the Aldborough Food and Drink Festival conference last year, and I knew fairly quickly that I really wanted him to be podcasted for this. So here we are. Alongside his wife Dulcie, Johnny has diversified the original dairy farm into a pioneering cheese and butter making business, focusing on making, and I'm quoting from their website here, exceptional artisan products, although I would agree, including the only traditional raw milk Brydamo style cheese produced in the UK. Johnny, thank you so much for speaking to me today.
No worries.
Before we talk about you, can we talk about the real stars of the show here, who are your Montbelliards, without which really your products couldn't be made? Why choose the Montbelliard, and what were you milking before they came? Because this is a family farm as well, family dairy farm.
So previous to the Montbelliard, we were like many farms where we gradually over the decades turned from a British Friesian into a Holstein dairy herd. It was really 2011 which really changed a lot in the thoughts I had of the direction our business was going. Up to that point, like so many farmers, it's about volume, large yields, and the Holstein was, you know, the perfect animal for that. But on the bad side of that is that when you put animals under a lot of pressure, they tend to get ill easier. It's a lot harder to farm those so the animal's healthy. It was once we got our milk shed set up, I realised that people were coming to buy our products because of the quality of it and not the quantity. I mean, the story's quite long, but gradually I started changing things on the farm, and that's why we changed to Montbelliard, mostly because cheese making, but it was the quality of their milk, which, you know, is why we're kind of where we are today.
And how did you select your cows? Did you go down to France?
I did, yeah. We went back in 2012. I managed to get in touch with a Montbelliard cattle dealer in the southeast region of France, and he was very keen on inviting us out for obvious reasons, since he's going to sell us some cows. And had 3 days trekking around the Jura region of France on the Swiss-French border, picking these Montbelliard cows. We bought 72, brought them back to the UK, and from that point onwards, the herd turned from a part of the herd was Montbelliard to now where we are, where they're nearly all Montbelliard.
Before you bought the original herd, take me back to that time in terms of what was going through your head in terms of innovating the business, and how did you get to that point? Were you visiting other places?
What, so this is previous sort of cheese, really?
Yeah.
So cheese. So I think it was originally frustration. You know, I got to age 29 and I was so frustrated with the dairy industry and the way dairy farmers were treated. No choice in what we were going to get paid. And on top of that, I think things have improved since then. People have woken up to that, realised that. But I feel like that we were really abused from milk, the milk industry, the big milk processors, and the supermarkets beyond them. And that bitterness or that anger really sort of what made me look for other things. And we actually started to look into having a flock of free-range hens.
Yeah.
Because egg price back then was, I mean, it's still not bad, but it was exceptionally good. We visited several hen farmers, and it was from the hen farmer idea where I saw his little shed at the end of the road where he sold all his seconds eggs and his jumbos, double yolkers. And I just was fascinated the amount of cars that kept pulling up, going in, getting eggs, putting a coin in a box, and off they go again. Yeah. And I just loved the simplicity of it. And I asked him how sort of much he made in a week from this honesty box thing. And he said, about 500 quid in cash. And I thought, well, hang on a minute. It's like, so you're doing nothing. You're literally putting your eggs on a shelf and people are going in there and collecting them and then paying you for it without having to man the shop or anything. And I thought, why are we not doing this in the dairy industry? It's like, I've never, ever seen anybody sell their milk. Mm. You know, back in the day, you know, a lot of farmers would have milk rounds, but farmers gradually got out of the milk round and concentrated on just producing milk, and because probably at that point in time it was actually better to sell to a dairy processor. But gradually, as you know, all of these milk roundsmen have disappeared, we've got to a point where there's nobody in the industry selling their own milk anymore. Things like pasteurisation puts people off. It's a lot of investment, a lot of equipment you have to buy. And I just went back that night and just thought about it. I spoke to my wife, Dulcie. I said, I think we ought to sell our milk. And so we started looking into it. The reason we went for raw milk was two reasons. We knew it tasted amazing. We were drinking it at the farm all our lives. And nobody was able to tap into this. And also the fact that, you know, raw milk, I didn't have to spend a lot of money to get going. Pasteurizing, bottle plant, all of that. I didn't need that to begin with. So with literally 600 quid, we got a garden shed, painted it like a cow, bought a secondhand fridge off eBay, glass front so you can see the bottles. We bought some luggage tags. We printed our own stickers. We stuck on the luggage tag. We tied the luggage tag to the bottle. We filled it up from the bulk tank, put it in our fridge, stuck £1 a litre on the fridge, on a bit, you know, written on a piece of card, put an honesty box in there. 30 litres went in there on August 2011, and the end of the day, there was, believe it or not, £30 in the box, just from filling up bottles. And gradually, as the weeks went by, we kept seeing the same customers coming back. We had a comments book in the little shed. People were writing comments like, oh my God, I can't believe milk tastes like this. I forgot that milk tasted so nice. And we just kept getting more and more of this. And gradually our sales grew. We were selling 100 litres a day. So it was really from that moment onwards, I just really rethought what direction we really should be taking with this.
So at that point it was all local market, local demand. How did you match your growth against that? So how quickly did you go from your 30 litres onward?
I think it was the first few months that just I completely sort of rethought what we were doing, because really it was only 2011. By the time we got to May 2013, we had a cheese making plant on the farm.
Let's actually turn to that. Yeah, let's talk about cheese.
Yeah,
where did that begin?
So I think after a few months with doing the honesty box scheme with our milk, I realised people were buying our milk because of the quality of it. I also realised that with raw milk, there's a lot of restrictions what you can and can't do with the stuff. And for us to go any further, to grow more and selling our own product, that raw milk was, there was always going to be a sort of, you know, a cap on it. You couldn't go any so far with it. Because people can buy our milk locally, but that's where it stopped. And I just thought, where else can we go with this? And making our own cheese seemed to be the logical next step. There was really hardly any cheesemakers in East Anglia. A small-scale farmhouse cheesemakers, there's very few really in the whole country when you look at it. Yeah. Cheese was good because you could use all your milk. I liked all of that. So I didn't have a clue about making cheese, what type of cheese to make. I must admit, I didn't even like some of it. It's a bit stinky, you know, when you get into the world of cheese. And but I thought, you know, let's investigate. So we went around the UK. We looked on the internet, found cheesemakers, farmhouse cheesemakers similar to us, which had been successful and done great things with their product. And we asked them, could we come and say hello and just see what they're doing? We're thinking of making cheese. So we did that. And that gave us ideas. Also gave us names of the people to meet in the industry, who, you know, the people who would be able to help us along the way with this, you know, when it comes to selling the cheese, advice on setting the building up, advice on making cheese. So we managed to eventually find a French cheesemaker, and we got in touch with him. He'd done a little consultancy work in the UK, and at this point we realised the cheese we wanted to make was a brie de meaux, a brie style cheese, raw milk brie. The reason why that cheese is because nobody was making it in the United Kingdom. Mm-hmm. You cannot find anywhere else raw milk brie, and you still can't as far as I'm aware. So that gave us something different, a niche. So we knew what type of cheese we were going to make. I learned from the people we visited that it came across that people who were successful with having a great cheese didn't tend to make that many more cheeses. They generally spent time concentrating on one cheese and sold it nationally and internationally, and they were known for that cheese. I like that idea. That's what I wanted us to achieve as well. Mm. So we focused on Brie. We got in touch with this French cheesemaker. He then suggested the Montbéliard cow because I wanted to do it properly. I wanted to, you know, the detail, you know, with a product, it's all the detail, isn't it, which makes the difference. We designed our building 2012, a smaller version of what we've got now. There was only so far we could sort of dare go with it. But, you know, from that point onwards, we created a good product. Interesting that one of the other good things I did right at the beginning was I was lucky enough that Anna Hill from Radio 4 was interested in our raw milk shed and did a story on us. And at the time I said, you know, maybe you'd like to come back when we start our new cheesemaking factory.
Yeah.
So Anna came back on the first day of cheesemaking, and it was, you know, it's a great start when you can get national radio on a new setup, starting a new business. And so, you know, we started to build up lots of interest right from the start.
When it comes to the raw milk, I'm interested in the questions that people ask you, or perhaps still ask you, because is there a perception out there that raw milk either has special health benefits or has certain dangers?
I would say it potentially could have both. By pasteurising milk, you can have a very, very strong chance that the milk is going to be safe to consume. Yeah. With raw milk, you don't have that easy way of making it safe. To make raw milk safe, you have to have very good farming practices. The animals themselves have to be healthy. They mustn't be overstressed. They mustn't be too much pressure put on them. The farm itself has to be well-maintained, rodent plan, clean water for drinking for the cows. And then it comes to the milking parlour, if you've got
The joys of HACCP.
Yeah, the HACCP. It's important that you create your own HACCP with it, so you can, you know, you can, everyone is using that to of the standards.
HACCP is another acronym, guys. It's Hazard Analysis Critical Control Point.
Yeah, that's it, yeah. Milking parlour, the cow's teats have to be really clean. You have to make sure there's mastitis in the cow's milk. You have to make sure your milking parlour is very clean, and you have to make sure every step of the way to where the milk goes into a bottle is exceptionally clean. And that way, your risk of anything harmful being in your milk is incredibly small.
Yeah.
So what you have to look at, you have to weigh up the two choices that you could, you know, say, let's ban raw milk, you know, because it might make somebody ill one day. Or the other side of it is it's proven out there that people are responding to drinking raw milk and making them healthier. It's not everybody, but there is a lot of studies done which has shown that people some people cannot drink pasteurized milk but can drink raw milk. Some people who have asthma drink raw milk and it goes away. There's a lot of people out there where this has happened to. So, you know, for the very tiny chance of somebody dying from it, to allowing many, many people to be able to have a better life in drinking raw milk, then I think that's, you know, that's the interesting sort of debate about it all. You know, but I think the key is with raw milk is that the people who sell raw milk have to be responsible and take great care in what they produce, and then the industry itself can grow.
Yeah. Now, as you've been describing, you've invested a huge amount in the business in recent years at a time when a lot of dairy farmers have pulled the plug and left the sector. Obviously, you have a very direct plan. What else is driving you to stay in dairying?
Oh God, I don't know. I don't even know why I'm here. Why do I do it? I must love it. I mean, sometimes it stresses me out.
Yeah.
But I just love being a farmer. I love being a dairy farmer. I love doing something like we're doing with the cheese and being recognised for doing something good. And that's what gets you out of bed in the morning. And you need money to invest in your buildings to have better facilities for the cows to, you know, make a bigger cheese building, you have to have the money. But that's not why I do what I do. It's because I just get a lot of satisfaction.
Yeah, it is a really difficult thing to describe, isn't it? Because I think it's the case with a lot of people in farming.
Yeah,
is that it's pinpointing why you do what you do. Because yeah, of course there's the business side, but there is this unspoken part as well.
I think there's a lot goes into it all. There's a habit in there as well. You get into a habit of doing something. There's that side of it. But there's also the, you know, being brought up on a farm and having that sort of in your blood from a child. It's very difficult to why farmers do what they do, because they're all nuts. Me being one of them. We're crackers. People do not go into farming to make money. You know, they do it because you love it, don't you? Yeah. You love being that outdoors person, seeing the seasons. You can't do any other industry where you can see seasons and experience the, you know, the conditions throughout the year as being a farmer.
Mm. Now, is it Baron Bigod or Bigod or Bigot or?
I think it's all three.
Okay.
So French is Bigot.
Yeah.
It's a French surname. It came over. The name came with a guy called Roger Bigot, probably back in 1066. He came over with William the First, conquered England. And William was very kind in letting him be the Lord of Norfolk or whatever it was at the time. So he built a castle at Norwich, and it was his family, the Bigod family, as what we call them now locally, but I think a lot of people call it Bigod. And it was his son, Hugh Bigod, which built the castle at Bungay. So I love my area where I live, and I'm very, you know, passionate about my little town and trying to do what I can to let people know it's a great place to come to if you want to come on holiday and that sort of thing. So I think with cheese, it's about having something connected with a name in the area connects with the cheese, because the idea is that cheese is unique to its surroundings, because it comes from the land. It's the animals which graze the land. It's the bacterias and the yeasts and the molds which are in our area, which all have that, what all creates that sort of uniqueness to every individual cheese, a farmhouse cheese, not factory cheese.
But you know, and you've gone from selling a few litres of milk in a fridge to you are now selling your cheese nationally and internationally. Was that planned?
No, it certainly wasn't planned. Wasn't. I mean, we didn't know where we were going to go. I envisaged we were going to do some farmers markets and sell locally. I didn't think we were going to end up getting to where we did. But yeah, it's just kind of gone really well for us, and we've won several awards, national awards, from our products and the farm. And yeah, we're now processing about 500,000 litres. Whereas what we started with 30 litres of milk on the first day, you know, on the farm, we've done that in just over 5 years, 6 years.
And Prince Harry had it on his wedding day, allegedly.
He did, allegedly. So the Daily Mail say. I mean, I can only go by what the Daily Mail tell me, but it was certainly on the menu. And yeah, and from that was actually, we got a lot of interesting, you know, press. A lot of stories off the back of having a local cheese. So it was on Look East and radio and local newspapers and things like that. So and interesting sales. Our cheese rocketed over the next 2 weeks off the back of that.
How did you meet Dulcie?
From the pub down at Bungay. So so I never met Dulcie before until I was 21. But she went to school at Halesworth, the next village down, and I went to Bungay, but we never met until we were in our early 20s. So you know, like you do as couples, you find you've got a lot in common with each other, don't you?
Yeah.
You like the same things and like sharing the same things, and also there's, you know, good partnerships or relationships. They tend to sort of, like, it brings out the best in you, doesn't it? So you you kind of one spur the other one on, sort of thing. So
And so her role in the business, from those early beginnings to now, what does she head up, as opposed to what you're heading?
What Dulcie sort of given to the farm, I think, is what I, as a farmer, haven't necessarily understood at the beginning. I understand it better now. But you need to have a certain style with your business and your brand. And Dulcie seemed to understand that better than me. So it's like the words we use, everything is thought about, it's nothing is done without a lot of thought behind it. And me, I'm just like, I love being productive and making good products, I suppose. So my passion has been the actual making the cheese and the butter and you know, having happy cows. And so, yeah, it's probably a good mix having the two.
One of the things I read last night in my research is, they say you should never read anything on the internet, but you walked from coast to coast.
I did. I didn't know how that got on the internet.
I don't know where that was, but I read that, yeah. So you walked from coast to coast. How long did that take, and what was going through your mind, and did that have any influence on the way you think generally?
I think I like epic stories, big stories. I'm a Lord of the Rings fan, and I walked from the coast to coast, the Alfred Wainwright, wasn't it?
Yeah. And
from St. Bees up in the Lake District over to Robin Hood's Bay. That was a year before we started making... No, it was a few years before we started making cheese and butter. But it was one of the best holidays I'd ever had.
Yeah.
Oh, you can't ever see stuff like you can when you're walking.
I completely agree. I mean, yeah, it was last year, a couple of years ago, I bought the Suffolk Coast Path.
Oh, right.
Which I think is supposed to be about 60 miles. It ended up being 72 miles. I don't know where those extra miles added on.
Donations to the
park. Yeah, absolutely. Just a few. And it does, doesn't it? It just, the whole pace of looking at life changes.
Changes. And just having that like break from the norm. Like, I walked for 2 weeks and I never got in a car for 2 weeks. I just walked everywhere.
Yeah.
And after about the first 3 days, my feet were crippling me, my knees ached, I slept in a tent in the cold and got wet. And you were thinking, why am I doing this? Like, just like, forget this, like, let's go and enjoy ourselves. But at the end of it was just the most enjoyable, satisfying thing I'd ever done. We always go for long walks now. Fortunately, with the kids, the coast to coast is maybe going to be a few more years before we revisit that one, but once they get a little bit older, maybe. But
I think that the article, or whatever it was, said that one of the things they want to do in the future is to walk it with you.
Yeah, they do. Yeah, my little boy Arthur, he wants to do the coast to coast. So he's fascinated. I tell him all of the little stories along the way of what we encountered, and he loves all of that.
Yeah. Another highlight for you, I assume, was that you and Dulcie won Dairy Innovators of the Year last year at the British Farming Awards. Tell me about that night.
Well, I might as well just get the wall down.
Amazing.
It was incredible. I just felt absolutely amazing off the back of that, because as a child and teenager, I'm being a farmer, typical farmer. I get the Farmers Weekly, the Farmers Guardian, and I scroll through the pages and look at like the new John Deere tractor or the you know, such and such bull has given so many excellent daughters and all of that, but every year you come around, you see awards and these like top dairy farmers winning them, and you always think, wow, God, if we could ever be as good as them. And yeah, so lo and behold, we win the Dairy Innovator, which is really makes me feel amazing. A great feeling. I think the fact that we won the Farmers Weekly Diversification Award the year before, and then this is kind of the same group as the Farmers Guardian, you know, be recognised 2 years on the trot from different magazines, it just really made us feel great. I really didn't expect to win either of them. The reason I didn't expect to win the first one, because I thought the other two finalists were like the way better than us, and then we won, and then the second time, the British Farming Awards award, I thought they're never going to say yes to us, because we won the one at the Farmers Weekly, and like, you know, you'd want to like give it to somebody else who hadn't won an award before, but no, they did. So
It's obviously and evidently well deserved. We're recording this episode during Veganuary, and we've got it'll probably be coming out during February-dary. And I was in two minds about discussing this, and I understand if you'd rather not go into too much detail.
No,
but
not at all.
If you Google your name, one of the first things to come up is pretty much the tirade of, or references to the tirade of abuse, and abusive messages that you've received via social media in the past by some extremist vegans, activists, including death threats and messages targeting your kids. Is the problem still there and underlying? And if so, what do you think can be done about it?
First of all, probably want to go back to like kind of how we got
give some context.
Roped into the vegan thing. So it was about this time last year, and it just literally was, we had three calves born by one heifer, and we thought, we never had this happen before. We thought, this is amazing. We'll put a picture on Instagram, Facebook. Got loads and loads of lovely comments. One local vegan retweeted or whatever the words,
whatever it was on,
and put it onto some vegan site. And have you ever seen those pictures where there's some guy killed a rhino and stood in, Facebook and there, and there's like 15 million views or something, and everyone's saying what such an evil person he is and all of that, which, to be fair, is probably true. The kind of same thing was happening with that picture. It just went from vegan site to vegan site. And the trouble is, as the hours and days went by, the shares got bigger and bigger.
Yeah.
So, every time someone shares it, that person probably has another few people who will share it again.
Yeah.
And the trouble was, it just got out of hand, but it was just going round and round with all of these vegan extremists around the world. We didn't reply to it. There's no point replying to stuff like that. It's just, what they were saying was completely inaccurate and wrong. But they started saying things like, between the vegans themselves, saying, maybe the farmer will die of cancer, will be his comeuppance. Maybe we should come round and take their children away and see how they feel. Really just getting quite disturbing. I can't remember. I think it was a local radio picked up on this and did a radio interview with me. And that then was picked up by the local newspaper, which then went to the regional newspaper, which then was sold to the national newspapers.
Right.
So then it ended up on pretty much every national newspaper, whether it's the paper or the website. Then radio, TV picked up on it. So I ended up, it just kind of got escalated and got to our original pictures were 100,000 views or comments and things like that.
Power of social media.
Yeah. And then it ended up going on national TV with This Morning, and sat next to some kind of like quite weird vegan who was really one of the stirrers of this episode of why it was getting out of control. And I learned a lot from the back of that. I mean, to sort of why were we picked on, I think it's quite obvious, because most dairy farmers don't have a website, which is a shame for the vegans, because they're aiming at the wrong place. If you're thinking about trying to have a go at a farmer who is abusing or mistreating his animals, you could probably start with more intensive units, where you've got hundreds of thousands of animals in one shed, probably would make more sense. Rather than a small dairy farm who's actually making a very high standard of animal welfare and looking after their animals. But they chose us because we're on social media, and we were more public speaking. But off the back of it, after it all sort of died down, is that I realised that we as farmers have really, and the whole of the country, we've really forgotten about food and farming and appreciated food and where it comes from. And I think that's one of the things which I'm trying to make a point that we need to understand as a nation where our food comes from. We need to understand that the difference between well looked after animals and not well looked after animals. And we also need to understand that it is not as straightforward to go vegan and save the world as you think, because the world is, it's very, things are very on a balance all the time. And as soon as you start changing that, as we're sort of seeing with Brexit, big consequences happen. And when you start thinking about what would happen, you know, if we all became vegan and what, you know, the everything would change, the habitats would change, the landscape would change. You forget that 60% of the farmland in the UK is pasture, and a lot of this land, the only thing you could actually grow on it is grass,
yep.
And the only use to us with grass is by having an animal what eats the grass and we eat the animal. So things are not straightforward. But
a former Meet the Farmers guest, actually. Sorry for picking on you, George, but George Young, who features in episode 22, actually argued in his episode, George is an arable farmer from South Essex, that the vegan movement could be seen, just playing devil's advocate a bit, as a positive thing for the food sector, because vegans are people who fundamentally care about what they eat, they think about what they eat, and are interested and engaged in conversations relating to food and food production methods. What would your response be to that view, that veganism can be a positive thing for food and farming?
I agree with him. I think that we are looking at several different things here. One's what targeted us. That's definitely not the right approach for a vegan. Mm. And I'm hoping that this year, that they're this veganuary, whatever's going on right now, that I'm hoping that they've realised that actually you put people off becoming a vegan if you act like that. But I do agree that I think that the future for us as humans is to eat less meat. Mm. And I'm all for that. I just think that we shouldn't rock the boat too much. Mm. And I think that where we get our meat from, that we should respect the animals, and we should just make sure that the meat, what we're eating, is from better sourced meat, better sourced dairy. The animals' welfare is looked after, the way the environment is cared for from that farm is also thought about. I think that's the future. I think that you have to be careful, like, just thinking that we're all going to become vegans one day, because the reason we, as humans, have got to where we are is because we eat meat. So I'd be very careful of that. I think it would be much more sensible to not overindulge in meat and dairy, but to eat it in proportion with other food. And just think a little bit more about what type of food you're eating.
Brilliant. It's 1 minute soapbox time, so this is a relatively new thing on Meet the Farmers. Guy Smith and Martin Lyons have been great support so far on this. So, Johnny, you have 1 minute to talk about any subject of your choice. This could be to do with farming, it could be to do with non-farming, up to you.
So my subject is boringly in farming. It's raw milk, and what I wanted to just say was that in the last year, me and one or two other raw milk producers have started work with the Food Standards Agency on creating a raw milk producers group. What was really lacking, and as the last sort of 5-6 years of more and more dairy farms turning to selling raw milk from their farm gate, is that we have no sort of association or group of people to go to for advice, and that's something which we've early days, but is going really well for us, so you've just got to watch this space. But it's for a better future for raw drinking milk in the UK.
Brilliant. Can we go and have a look round?
Yeah.
And maybe eat some cheese.
Yeah, definitely. Let's do it.
I've just got Ben with me. We're going to do a tour round. We'll meet you on the way round.
So we are white booted, white coated, hair netted up, and we're in Cheese HQ. Johnny, tell me what we're seeing.
So we're just coming in corridors at the moment, but this is our new cheese making facilities. This building is an improved version of the old building. The flow of it is better. It's designed specifically for our cheese. So we move into this room. Where we're standing now is two big tanks on two tall stands. And as you look through the window, that's the milking parlour. So we are a proper farmhouse cheese because it's made on the farm. There is literally yards between where the cows are milked and where the cheese starts being made. The beauty about what we do is the milk doesn't age. It's not chilled, it's not reheated. It comes straight from the cow, body temperature, drops into our tank, and that's the start of the cheese making. So this morning, cows were milked, 4 a.m., 4:30 a.m., cultures were added to our milk to start the acidification process. So that's where it all began.
So that's sort of the start of your daily routine.
Yeah.
Yep. Come in here first.
For me, no, I'm currently feeding cows part of the morning. So Mark and Steve, our head cheese makers here, they're here early. And they start by adding the culture. So the lactic bacteria starts to eat the lactose in the milk, the sugars, and that creates acid. The acid is a really important part of our cheese. The forming of acid in the milk is something to do with the structure and the flavour of the cheese, but also it's a safety measure. So we can't rely on this, like this, what we see here is a pasteuriser. We're not relying on pasteurisation to make our product safe. We're relying on acidification. As pathogenic bacteria don't like acidity, they can't grow in that sort of conditions.
And how long is the process from your raw milk to your end product cheese?
We're talking about 7 to 8 weeks you want to eat our cheese from the day we make it.
Right, where should we go now?
Move on to the next room. So from the tank, it then moves into the second room. This is the renneting room. And all of the milk, once it reaches a certain level of acidity, it gets, the tap is opened and the pipe runs. So everything in this building is gravity fed. There's no pumps involved. So the milk runs into these little vats here. And this is the way Brie de Meaux would be made in France. Okay. It's all in smaller vats. And then you add the rennet at this point. The rennet is an enzyme from a calf stomach. It goes in and it turns milk into a solid. It cuts these little hairs off each protein called capsaicins. And once it snipped them off, the proteins become like magnets. They stick to one another. And that locks all of the moisture in and the fats in and the minerals and all of these things are locked in. And then that's its first sort of stage of cheese making. Once the rennet has made the curd form, we then wait a certain amount of time and then we cut the curd with long knives. That helps some of the whey separate. So the whey and the curd start to separate, the whey comes to the top. We then take the whey off the curd, and we wheel the vats into this room, and this is our making room, and this is the cheese we've made today. Mm. So every one of these has had a ladle, which has done a thin slice of curd and placed it into the hoop. So it's nothing is smashed, the curd isn't smashed, it's all gently laid down into the moulds. And then after a certain amount of time, the curd keeps draining down, and the top hoop comes off. And at that point, the cheese is then turned. So this has all taken a lot of time to just get the perfect amount of curd, the perfect amount of moisture. There's so many factors in, like, just, you know, understanding the balance of it all. So this is the salt room. So we've half salted yesterday's cheese. So what happens is cheese on day two are put on racks. The racks then, with the cheese on top, go over this conveyor belt. They touch this as the conveyor belt moves round, and this box here shakes a little bit of salt on on the cheese as it goes through it.
And how vital is the salting process?
Very important. It's one of the most important steps the whole make. It depending on the amount of salt that goes on the cheese will depend on what type of growth of molds and yeasts will grow. So too much salt, a certain flavour will come off from that. Too little salt, same again, a certain type of mold will grow on it. So the cheese gets salted on one side and it's turned over this afternoon and we'll have the second side. Currently it's living in this room.
Uh-huh.
So this is yesterday's cheese. You can the smell of this room, put the haste in the room, and for the second day to the fourth day of cheese making, it's about 17 degrees in here, and this is the room which helps start the mould growth. So by day two, the little pools of whey will be gone.
Yeah. So I mean, looking at it at the moment, this is from day two. It's about, it's like a sort of. It's a thick, thick cream consistency. It's like slightly thicker than that, but holding together and.
You can see it's a cheese, but it's really just curd.
Yeah.
Salted curd.
Yeah, that salt is very significant coming through.
Yeah. Yeah, a lot of salt. Mm. But that will all disappear gradually.
What advice would you give to a dairy farmer who is interested in diversifying into either ice cream or cheese making or some other added value product, where would you begin?
I would be looking towards a gap in the market, a niche product, something different, even bringing something back from what was popular once and isn't anymore. Do your research before you go into anything. And that then gives you a good story. When someone buys an expensive piece of cheese, then they want to not only buy it because it tastes nice, but to understand the story behind it. It's, to be successful, you've got to have, with this kind of product, you've got to have the good story to go with it. So you need to think about all of those before you go into whatever you're going to do. So this room is like that room, it's just once again turned off. We come into the packing room. So cheeses are brought in here. This fan is turned on. It's just to try and dry the rind a little bit. It's important that we dry the rind before we wrap it in paper because it gets a bit damp underneath the paper.
Okay.
So it sits in here for a few hours before it's wrapped in paper. We've got our wooden boxes, the cheese lives in. And then why we designed the building is the washroom is central. And here is the noisy washroom. We've got a big dishwasher there, and everything is can come into the washroom in the centre of the building without going back through some of the rooms where cheeses are.
So we're now in the chiller room.
Yeah, so the cheeses have been wrapped. They've been put in the boxes. Little wooden boxes made from poplar wood. The box we sourced from France. Very few people use this box in the UK at present. But I think it's a great way of helping the cheese mature on without losing the moisture out of it. It's a good little home for it. And also shows off your product brand, the name of the product.
Mm.
So as we look in this room, it's in batch order. So the youngest cheese at that end of the room, three different sizes. And then we get to this end of the room, you've got the cheeses, next one's going out.
How much do you know about your customers in terms of who they are, what they want?
Well, it's important to keep asking them what they want, but I mean, our customer is going to be someone, people who care about food, who like high-end food, good quality food. Customers who buy our products are people who want tasty food, but also care about where their products come from and know the story. So there's also places where our product really wouldn't suit, and it would devalue our product. So we also have to be careful who we sell to, so we don't go against what we stand for and what our business stands for.
So we are actually now looking out on the cows, who are very happily, half of them are lying down, half of them are standing feeding. When are they? When do you put them out? In the spring. It depends.
As soon as we can. You have to be realistic that the winter can still bite you.
Yeah.
Even if you, you know, you go for early March ideally, but we've had terrible weather in the middle of March, end of March. You end up bringing them back in again. So it's just, it's not before March, but I think the best we've ever done is about the 13th of March.
And I think I'm right, and you're carving in two blocks?
Yeah, we carve in two blocks. I like the carving block system because I can concentrate all of our time on, focus on one area of the cow's lactation at a time. But in an ideal world, I'd have everything carved in September and October.
Yeah.
But because we need milk for cheese making all year round, we decided to bring in a second block of cows carving, which happens in February and March. So this group here are awesome carving cows. So see that old Montbelliard, she's one of the original ones from France there. She's, look at the sort of the width of her. Big old girls, aren't they?
Beautiful, beautiful animal. And is the aim to work towards a 100% pure Montbelliard
bird?
Yeah,
it will become eventually pure, but we took the decision to buy some cows in, and we'd a close herd. We decided to be able to sort of get ahead of ourselves. It's going to take so many years to eventually turn into a Montbelliard herd just by breeding Holsteins with Montbelliard. So we brought in, like I said, 72 cows, and we've bred everything from that day onwards to a Montbelliard. So there's a lot of Montbelliard cross Holstein, but then their daughters are now turning out red and white, so they actually look like a Montbelliard.
Yeah.
By the time you get another two or three generations, it will be all the Montbelliard cow.
Johnny Crickmore at Fen Farm Dairy in Suffolk. And if you'd like to learn more about the Crickmore family and Baron Bigot cheese, check out their website, which is www.fenfarmdairy.co.uk. Next time on Meet the Farmers will be a little bit different, as I'll be speaking to Andrew Dewing, who is a grain merchant, chief executive of Dewing Grain, and host of the Dewing Grain podcast. I'm Ben Eagle, and thank you for listening to the Meet the Farmers podcast. Thank you especially if you are a new listener. It's great to have you on board, and please do tell your family and friends about the podcast. And if you're feeling really generous, please do give it a little plug on social media. I'd really appreciate that. You can hear all previous episodes at thinkingcountry.com, and I look forward to you joining me next time.